Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2022, October 7. And yes, I be John Pasmino. Be sure you have both files, audio and video, for this session. The topic for today is Mars in 2022, because now through December, Mars has toured and through its biannual opposition, best time for viewing, and then leaves opposition, but is still in good viewing position into early 2023. So, if you do not have both files, audio, which you're listening to, and video with the slideshow, stop at www.nysskies.org. Among the jump words on the home page, toward the right, you'll see audio video files. Check it. On this new page, AV files page, explains why you do need the both files. It also reminds you about the New York Skies e-group, and at the bottom of the text are the links to the seminars. There are about a year and a half's worth online. The one you're looking for is near the bottom, and it's titled Mars in 2022. And just download the video file if indeed you missed it. I left you with a quiz last time. Okay, you do have the video up and running and you're standing on slide one. Okay, the quiz last time was related to the retrograde loops of Mars, and I showed you an example for this year's go-around during opposition as part of activities to do during the autumn months. But I asked, the shape of that loop, is that the same for all oppositions? Now normally I would give the answer right up front on slide one before the title, but actually the answer is best handled within the lesson itself. Slide one is a late breaking news, a bulletin, a news flash regarding my own self. And you can read the chit chat on it, but in short, I am, after 54 years, and retiring from my engineering career, and enter the magical world of retired life. And I emphasize this for you folk because many of you were used to conversing with me through my office. All the contacts and channels at work were deactivated during the coronavirus episode. And although my office opened again in September, I felt that after so long a career, that it's probably time to lay down my slide rule and triangles and tables, that is, numerical tables, and charts, and blueprints, and all that stuff, and So from now on, my contacts will all be at home. And I give you the email, john.pasmino@netzero.net, and my home telephone, 718-252-0388. Of course, those who answered the quizzes during the pandemic and the subsequent lockdown and very slow recovery were using these and also the New York Skies email group. So now it's official, those be the ones to get in touch with me. Okay, so now we move to slide number 2. Okay, slide 2 summarizes the AV files page in reverse order. That is, if you happen to have the slideshow, but you're missing the narration, then it sends you to the AV files to pick that up. On the bottom are links to several articles relating to Mars. The first one, K-E-P-Papa-L-P-Papa-A-R, is Kepler Parallax. And it goes through the method that Kepler, in the early 1600s, used to map out the orbit of Mars in 3D space and show that it was, in fact, an elliptical orbit rather than an off-centered circle. That's a lot of fun for you to walk through that exercise. And you can actually duplicate his work using modern planetarium software. And in fact, your club or your school may want to put it out as a weekend project or assignment and then compare the results at the meeting the following week. The next one, Mars 2010, is a deep dive into the opposition, which was went through by the in-person meetings of the New York Skies in 2010. We started the seminars in 2007, and we had gone through at each opposition a special session, and by the time 2010 came along, enough material was gathered to put into a good review article. Mars Parm, M-A-R-S, P-Papa A-R, M, a table of various facts and figures about Mars during its orbit, and this is an average out set for a circular coplanar orbit. So, but if by chance you don't have other references specific to the year you're observing Mars, this is a good starting point. And it also illustrates how, if you know computer languages, you can write a program, which is what I did here, write a program to generate such a table, and the bulk of that article is the printout from that program. It's a software, although they don't teach programming anymore, or they teach scripting more than anything else. Alright, Mars OPPN and Mars OPP2 are tables of the oppositions of Mars, the first one being a simple one, and the second one for recent and near future positions, near future, going out into the 2061. It's actually a little interesting, and a segment of it is given within this lesson, so we'll talk more about that at that time. Okay, slide 3 goes into Mars. Well, by now you notice the Mars-colored border on the picture, and that's the same throughout the lesson. And then the lower right corner is turned up to reveal the slide number. Okay, we are now looking at a planet rather different, radically different from Jupiter and Saturn, which we reviewed during the summer months. Models of Earth, Venus, and on the lower row, Mars, Mercury, and Pluto. Pluto is the farthest planet from the Sun, but the other four are clumped together around the Sun and are called the inner planets. And Jupiter, Saturn, also Uranus and Neptune are the outer planets. The distinction is not just the location in the solar system, but also their physical makeup. Jupiter and Saturn were, well, still are, gas giants. They're much bigger than the Earth, and the bulk of their volume is gas, maybe deeply compressed, probably even to a liquid down near the center. So the surface is essentially cloud, and the markings change hourly almost, or certainly during one night of observing. There's no permanent ground that we look at. The inner planets, the bulk of their volume is solid in the sense that there's an actual surface with features, topography, that is essentially permanent. Venus does have an atmosphere. It's a thin one compared to the entire diameter, and it just by dumb luck is opaque in the optical range. The swirly things on the model were those taken by space probes in, I think, ultraviolet. But to the eye at the telescope or ordinary imaging, Venus is plain, pure snow white. Earth has an atmosphere, you see the white clouds. Mars has an atmosphere, it too is thin, and Mercury and Pluto have none, but they all have solid surfaces which by close-up space probe visits we see has, you know, mountains and valleys and cliffs and craters and basins and plains, and of course the Earth has its oceans. We're going to base our quiz for this lesson on this slide 3. I'll get you started and we'll put it all together at the end. Look at Earth, look at Mars. Mars is pretty much half the diameter of Earth. Mars, now that we've visited, you know, many, many times by space vehicles, has no open surface water. So the entire area of Mars is land. Even the glaciers at the poles sit on land. Earth is a mix of water, that's the blue part, and the earthy colored areas is land. And then the land and water are obscured from time to time by clouds. So the question would be to relate the area of Mars with the land area of Earth, and we'll come back to that later. But that gives you visualization of the sizes of the planets. In numbers, Mars is around 6,400 kilometer diameter, and the Earth is 12,800, and Venus is around 12,000 flat kilometer diameter, and the other two are even smaller. A table of facts and figures about Mars taken from the NASA JPL is in slide 4, and you can just keep this with your reference material and pour through it as you need it. The planets Mercury through Mars, apart from being inner in the sense of close to the Sun, are also called terrestrial planets because they resemble the Earth more than, say, Jupiter. I've also heard the term telluric. T-E-L-L-U-R-I-C-C. That's one C. And that comes from the Latin word tellus, meaning a nutrient nourishing or Mother Earth. The only other example in astronomy are the telluric lines that appear in spectra, and that is generated by atoms and molecules in our own Earth atmosphere, not celestial in the star or interstellar medium. And so we have Mercury through Mars, and you can crosswalk between them for comparison. I mentioned that Mercury through Mars are huddled together close to the Sun. In fact, the distance from the Sun out to Mars is about 1.5 times the Earth's distance from the Sun, and so you have a nice compact group. In fact, it kind of resembles what we are finding on planetary stars, the solar system or stellar system that they have tend to be smashed close together to the central star. There are only a few examples where the planets are many Earth-Sun distances away. On this scale, the orbit of Jupiter actually would completely enclose the picture, not even reaching the four corners. That's the orbit of Jupiter. And the region in between Jupiter and Mars is the realm of the bulk of the asteroids. And then Saturn is outside the corners of your display screen and probably off of the table that it sits on. And then the other planets go to the walls of your room, and Pluto is someplace outside the window. So that gives the scale. Now, if you sit back on this size of picture, the orbits are pretty circular. Yet even so, you see that Mars has an orbit which is very distinctly off-centered from the Sun. It's farthest away around the 10 o'clock position and closest in around the 4 o'clock position. That is, the perihelion of Mars is around 4 o'clock and the aphelion around 10 o'clock. And that plays a very important role in the variety of oppositions. Opposition is the period, that is the span of time, when the Earth and Mars are on the same side of the Sun, and therefore Mars is near his closest approach to the Earth. Where they are out of line, Mars is in one part of his orbit, the Earth in another of her orbit, and the distance between them can be way too far for convenient viewing of the plane. We also have a situation of eccentricity for Mercury, which accounts for the radical differences in their elongation of that planet from the Sun, which I think varies, I think it's 19 degrees at a perihelion elongation to around, I think it's 28 degrees for a aphelion. That's why some greatest elongations are reasonably easy to see, and others are tough, or the planets just dissolved away in twilight. The early astronomers, the before Copernicus, used the geocentric model with the Earth in the middle, as in slide 6, down in the lower left corner. And then the planets revolve around the Earth in orbits, which were called deferent, D delta E F E R E N T tango, but each of them had a subsidiary circle, a rider circle, called the epicycle, E P papa I C Y C L E. The very planet itself rides in the epicycle, and it's the epicycle that then goes around the Earth. The reason for this weird system is that the combined motion and speeds of the two circles would mimic rather closely, certainly for bare eye observations, the speed and the direction of motion of the planets in the sky. Now, we have for the Moon, closest to the Earth, and the Sun do not have epicycles because they do not change direction. They change their speed slightly, but they do not actually reverse track and start running upstream in the zodiac. And while the planet is in the closer side of the epicycle to the Earth, its motion is reversed because the speeds act against each other, and we enter the retrograde loop. We saw this for Saturn and Jupiter, but because their orbits are almost coplanar with the ecliptic, the central line of the zodiac, the retrograde loop is really a swaying back and forth, or like a car that's jockeying trying to park against a curb. Mars is a little more tilted to the ecliptic, and of course is the closest of those planets beyond the Sun. The reverse motion can actually generate a zigzag or S or loop path on the sky. Mercury and Venus also have epicycles, and they have retrograde loops. We normally don't think of them because they occur in strong twilight or daylight when there are no background stars to recognize that they're traveling in reverse direction. We come to the distinction also among the planets. Those which are closer or under the Sun, as seen from the Earth, are the inferior planets, and the or interior planets. The ones farther from the Earth than the Sun are the exterior or superior planets. Alright. The opposition, that is when the Earth and Mars are abeam of each other relative to the Sun, is in December, actually, the 8th of December. So why am I giving you this Mars lesson now, near the beginning of October, 2 months early? Well, the reason is, I really want you to experience, not just telescopically, the disk and its changes over this period and into 2023, but also if you have binoculars as your prime optical aid, follow Mars into, through, and out of his retrograde loop. And Mars is in our sky, among the brightest of the stars, right now. Now, in slide 7, which was the same one I used for the autumn sky session, it's cut for November 8th, which is the night of the lunar eclipse. So it's in the east, up there near the upper left corner, near the star Elnath, we have Mars, and the hour is 2100. So we are in late evening. By the way, we are back into standard time by the time of the eclipse, so it's good and dark. And now in October, you get the same scene, around 2230. If you look in the east, well, you recognize the Pleiades and the Hyades. They're over there on the left side. You see the horizon arc around the bottom with the compass directions. The zenith, or overhead, is about a third down from the top center, and I have the many other stars of the autumn sky labeled. If you're a little rusty about them, do play again the autumn sky session. Go back to the AV files page, and it's one of the session at the near the bottom. I think it's actually called New York. That is the words New York skies in fall 2022. See, but you can start observing Mars now. Now, actually, if you go out tonight after playing this lesson, Mars is about halfway between the Hyades and the Pleiades. And through October, it moves eastward in direct motion. And by the time November starts, it has just entered the retrograde loop. And we'll see that a little later on. So now we jump in slide 8 to the night of the opposition itself, when nominally Mars is closest, not exactly so, and I have a slide to show you that, pretty close, and it's also about the brightest, and it's going to be really bright, -2.5 magnitudes, so it would actually outshine Jupiter, which in slide 7 you see where Jupiter is. It's high and mighty in the southeast to south sky, and then Mars is rather farther to the east. So here we are, Mars way up there on the left side of the picture. You see Fomalhaut near the bottom. That's an ordinary first magnitude star. The right side has a pop-up, which this particular planetarium program has built in the solar system, which I zoomed in to show the planets out to Mars, somewhat like a couple of slides back. But here I emphasize the lineup: Sun in the center, E for Earth, M for Mars. The three are in a line, at least in terms of the longitude or circular position along the ecliptic. Mars is not in line with the sun in latitude north to south. This is actually a little off of the ecliptic, and actually in the previous picture where I had the ecliptic, that was a sweeping arc southwest going to the upper left of the picture. The Mars is not on the ecliptic. It's enough away to show the loop as an actual curlicue. So there is the lineup. A question that many people ask is, ooh, what would it look like if I were on Mars? Or what would it look like in the sky if I were on the Sun? Well, if you use a solar system simulated program, you get the answers in the next couple of slides. I surprised you! Alright, so we have here slide 9. Another way to show the concept of opposition, at least as viewed from the Earth, by using an astrology program. You did play the lesson a couple of sessions ago on astrology for astronomers. Well, here is a doctored up horoscope which I cut for midnight on December 8th. The horizontal line, east on the left, and then the double dash line, which I put in myself, and then west on the right, is the horizon. You're in the middle of that. The arc of the ecliptic, which is where the degrees are labeled, is above the horizon and visible, and the arc under the horizon is out of the sky. Since I made this for roughly midnight, if you look near the bottom around 6 o'clock, you'll see this symbol for sun, which I labeled, and the angle scale, which on the screen can be rotated, I zeroed it on the sun. In high sky, 180 degrees away, you see the symbols for Mars and Moon. What the hell is the Moon doing up there? Oh, look at Mars first. That's 180 degrees away from the Sun. Now, in this astrology program which I play with, to avoid clutter, the planets are placed a little away from the angle scale, and a little blue leader points to the actual spot on that angle scale. So you see the mark for Mars quite 180 degrees away, and that is the concept of opposition. You're in the middle, you look in one direction to see Mars, and you look in the other direction to see, well, where the Sun would be if the Earth were transparent and had zero refractive. Actually, if you were in a space capsule orbiting the Earth, then during the 90 minute circuit of the Earth, you would see the Sun and Mars, and you can see for yourself how the two line up relative to the Earth. You see the one, the other is blocked by the globe of the Earth, and then you see the other with the Mars blocked by the Earth, and that's the concept of opposition. Now, what the hell is the Moon doing there? Well, toward the end of the lesson, we'll learn that this year's apparition of Mars is a double treat. You have all the usual features of opposition, par loss. Well, I don't want to give it away yet. Okay, slide 10. We'd be on Mars and looking into the sky of Mars. Well, of course, Mars has daylight just like the Earth does, so alright, you're in a one of the moons, the Deimos or who's the other guy? Phobos, and which have no atmospheres. And you're looking, there's the sun over there on the left. The the big yellow dot label, and just under it, in conjunction with the sun, is Earth, the little blue dot. All of humanity, and all of history, and all of culture and civilization lives on that little blue dot. And if Putin has his way, or Xi Jinping has his way, or Kim Umo, or whatever his name is, has his way, or the Ayatollah Yahya Yoga in Iran has his way, all of that will go up, poof, by the time of the next opposition. Okay. The conjunction occurs in the sky of Mars in Scorpius Ophiuchus, and I labeled Antares for you, and the two stars, one at 2 o'clock from Antares and around 7 o'clock from Antares, are the Pericordia stars. They have their Arabic name, which I just often forget, but the Pericordium Prior is the right-hand, the western one, 2 o'clock, and Pericordium Posterior is the one at 7 o'clock to the left or east. Now, they are the Greek names, which simply mean in the vicinity of the heart. Peri, as a prefix, and cordion, the Greek name, or from the Greek word for heart. Okay, so that is what we would see if we were on Mars, Earth being in his or her inferior conjunction between Mars and Sun. If we then hop over to the Sun in slide 11 and look up toward Mars, bear in mind, there's no nighttime on the Sun. It's daytime all the time, of course. But you can kind of imagine that by some really sophisticated filtration, you can get rid of the glow of the corona and chromosphere and see the stars in a dark background. And we look there up toward Mars, and right next to Mars is Earth. So Earth and Mars enjoy a conventional, classical, planetary conjunction, like the ones we see on Earth between, say, Mars and Jupiter, or Jupiter and Venus, or Venus and Saturn, or whatever. And that occurs, as seen from the Sun, in Taurus. And you have the Hyades, Pleiades, Aldebaran, as I labeled Elnath at the top. And if you have a solar system simulator, you can do this for other planetary aspects or configurations to compare the Earth view with the view you would have on the planet or on the Sun. It's very instructive. You might want to correlate this with, say, an actual model. It doesn't have to be all that much to scale, and a small hand mirror of some sort, from a compact or a facial mirror, a dental mirror even, and you align three spheres about 2 meters apart on a table, and have a person stand next to the middle one, that's the Earth, and with the mirror he looks out to see Mars, he flips the mirror over and he sees the other ball, that's the Sun. And then if you stand at the Sun's ball and look out, you see the Earth and Mars balls side by side or one above the other, and also going to Mars, look back at Earth and Sun side by side. But that is what you can, and you can show the picture for validation that you did this correctly. It's a lot of fun. The club will love this. The classroom will love this. The loop, the loop, the retrograde loop, the loop, the loop. I know the last session I used this slide just to introduce you to the opposition of Mars during the 4 months, and instantly I mentioned that in the next slide we'll look at the opposition of Mars. All of you flipped to the next slide before I even told you to, because you're really chomping at the bit. You're just chewing the edge of your table. I want to see Mars go through the loop. Okay, here's the loop again. Mars enters the scene. This is Taurus. You see the Pleiades, the Hyades, and Elnath. That's one of the horns of the bull. A couple of stars at the bottom belong to Orion, and the ones at the top of the page are for Aurea, and the ones at the extreme left go into Gemini. So Mars enters from his normal direct motion over the last 2 years, since 2020, into the scene, and I put little arrows here and there to show the direction, and right now, beginning of October, it's near the start of his path on this picture between the Pleiades and the Hyades, and he's chugging away eastward, and then he does a wheelie coming around the bend where it says West Station at the east end of the loop. Hardy, hardy, hardy. Yes, that's correct. That is correct. At the east end of the loop, and then he charges westward against the zodiac signs, almost all the way back to the Pleiades, which he reaches in late January of 2023. But instead of rounding a loop and coming back, he bounces off or reflects, well, you know, a guardrail shield surrounding the Pleiades, which is rammed up against, like a hockey player thrown against the boards, and begins his direct motion again, and he sails off out of Taurus into Gemini, and we wave bye-bye, well not really bye-bye, but bon voyage, until his 2025 opposition. And the question I last asked you last time, is this the shape of all the retrograde loops of Mars? Now, everyone who answered said, no, it is not, because they went to the planetarium programs and did tracings for a couple of other oppositions, and the loops did, in fact, have different shapes. But no one came to me and said, aha, there's a pattern to these shapes correlated with such and such other such and such, so that if I know the opposition date, I know what shape the loop would be. No one did that. But the next couple of slides will illustrate what's going on. In 13, I just copied over the previous slide. I put it in the upper left corner, and in the lower right, I have the retrograde loop for 1975, which also occurred in December. And you notice that the loops are essentially the same. You have a nice round hairpin turn at the entrance into the loop, and then a reflection or ricochet off at the end of the loop before resuming direct motion. Now the key to this is the shape of the loop is gained to the date of the opposition, which in turn is gained to the location in the ecliptic. So loops that occur in December, like mid-December, have this shape, and this loop occurs when the opposition is in Taurus. So now you can run back to your planetarium program and generate a set, which I did, that's how I got that lower right picture, for say 12 intervals during the year. You'll have to go to a table of oppositions like the ones I listed in the title slide, the Mars opposition articles, and pick out those which occur in various months and post them into your planetarium program and generate these curves. In slide 14, we see loops for April in the upper left, and they occur in Virgo, the star just on the Lupus speaker. And then in the lower right, loops that occur in August, which is in Aquarius area. And this is a textbook type of loop, where the planet actually does a, like an airplane, an aerobatic airplane kind of loop. And they would occur during the August oppositions in Capricorn's Aquarius area of the sky. And if you did that, it might actually be instructive to do this set of 12 and then put them out on a wall in sequence. And this way, your club or school members can actually visualize the transition of loop shape with a place within the ecliptic. If you were lucky enough in prior years to be a photographer, you may have photographed Mars during their opposition loops, maybe a couple of sample scenes, and then on your planetarium you can bullet the place of Mars on the date that you took the pictures. Very instructive. It also gives you some context of your lifestyle. Hey, you know, during that opposition of Mars in that year, I graduated high school. Or my office went out of business and I had to go job hunting. Or I met a person who would be my life mate, but after 2 months of living together, we had to break up. Well, whatever. So that's some life incident, a meter point in your life, can be hooked onto events in the sky. It gives you a bonding between what goes on in the cosmos in the fifth essence, the quintessence, and those on Earth for the four earthly essences. We go back to our astrology program in slide 15. Astrologers, in addition to being all hyped about the position of the planets in the zodiac, have a real hex on their speeds, degrees per day. And one of the graphics that the planetarium astrology-based planetarium program, by the way, you know, because I call it, because the horoscope picture is a stylized planetarium scene of the ecliptic. So when I say astrology program, I'm really referring to the features within it that relate to astronomy, including graphics like the one you're looking at on slide 15. The horizontal direction is downrange through the zodiac, and the center line, the signs of the zodiac are noted, but they're kind of hard to see, so I posted in the constellation themselves, the signs, 30-degree blocks downrange. The vertical scale, unfortunately, in this program is not dimensioned, but at the top is a horizontal line. That refers to the maximum speed, forward speed, of the particular planet. For Mars, that's why I say they're not labeled. The horizontal line in the middle is zero speed, that is, the planet came to rest, and speeds below are negative, meaning reversal of direction. So coming in from the left, we have Mars, and as it comes to the time of the retrograde loop, its speed slows down. It's getting lower and lower toward the zero speed, and also you notice that its forward motion decreases. And when it gets to zero speed, where it's labeled West Station, it's standing still. That is, the path right at that point is vertical, neither moving east or west. That's the entrance point into the retrograde loop. The loop itself takes place at negative reverse retrograde speed below the zero line, and actually comes to a maximum right near our position. I say right near because sometimes it occurs near proximity, which we'll come to in a few slides. And then the opposition is over. If Mars finishes its loop, but now it's slowing down, that is, coming back towards zero speed, and it hits the zero speed line at the eastern station. That's at the west end of the loop. You're standing on your head already. East, west, east, west. Someday I'll explain that to you. Then, I'll say it later. Then the speed becomes positive because it's resuming direct motion, and it roars off the upper right part of the chart, and it'll go a couple of times around the zodiac. That is, the cycle of zodiacs repeats after Aries, you go back to Taurus and continue until 2025, and you'll have a loop similar to this in that year. East is east and west is west. Okay, the point where the planet enters this loop, zeroes out its speed, is a certain angular displacement from the Sun. And for the superior planets, the shorter displacement is on the west side of the Sun. The longer direction would be from the Sun, wrapping all the way the opposite way around the sky, and then coming to that position. So it's the shorter elongation is west of the Sun and at the eastern end of the loop. The western station, which will be, that's what we saw, I think it occurred it occurs at the end of October, October 30th and October 31st. The eastern station would be a lot easier to observe because that occurs in the nightfall hours, and that would be at the end of the loop, and it would be a lot more obvious that the Sun just set and Mars is at a certain eastern elongation from the sun when it leaves the loop at the west end of the loop. So that clears up your topsy-turvy east-west. It all hinges on the fact that the sky is not a linear structure like a railroad or a highway, but is circular like the shoreline of an island. I'm sure you've heard the silly joke. A man is walking along the road and he asks a person, he meets up a how far is it to Edisonville? And the roadside fellow says, well, in the direction you're walking, it's 40,000 kilometers. If you turn around, it's only 3 kilometers. Because the man happened to be heading away from Edisonville. He was lost, I guess. And he would have to walk all the way around the earth to reach it. So that's sort of a geometry. And that's why so many of us in high school, we barely squeaked through plain geometry in 10th year math. And when the grade advisor suggested that you take solid geometry, that's when you decided in college, I'm going to take Indian Affairs studies. Slide 16 uses a solar system simulator for another way to explain and illustrate features of the retrograde loop. This is a geocentric view. Earth in the middle. You see the sun down there around 7:30 o'clock. The orbit it is on is pretty circular and it goes around the Earth, always in direct motion. The curlicue path is Mars, and I let it run for two oppositions. I label them number one and number two. The point of this diagram is to show not only the reversal of direction, but also the radical range of distance of Mars from Earth. At the opposition, and if you're thinking in terms of the epicycle and deferent, then at that point, number one, number two, Mars is at the lower or closer or inner side of the epicycle, and at the top of the page, Mars is near the outboard or higher end of the epicycle, and they correspond to the superior conjunction, where Mars is on the far side of the Sun. You see, it's outside the orbit of the Sun. And that range is considerable. It's roughly 5 to 1. And that will have severe consequences in the home astronomer and to some extent the observatories before the space age to observe the planet. We can only do good observations when the planet is reasonably close to the Earth, certainly less than 1 AU away, and hopefully in the area of 0.5 AU. Beyond that distance, the disk of Mars is really too small to get good views of its surface markings. Bear in mind, the light from Mars not only has to pass through our atmosphere, which is turbulent and the effect of seeing conditions, but also has to pass through the atmosphere of Mars. So if you have a planetarium, a solar system program, pin the Earth still and let Mars do its thing, and you get a diagram like this, and of course the labels I put in myself. Well, what is the size range? So the distance is kind of 5 to 1. With how severe can that be in the size of the planet in the sky? Now, when we saw Jupiter and Saturn, the change in size from superior conjunction on the far side of the Sun to opposition didn't seem all that severe. That's why you can observe those planets reasonably well as long as they stand out against the background sky. Once you're in twilight, it gets a little dicey. However, I will say this, a trick that many Jupiter observers play, they will observe Jupiter in twilight. That is, when they can first see it in the sky, and the sky is still kind of bright around it, because that removes the glare that can really hurt you if you see the brilliant disk on a black field in your eyepiece. And I've done this many times, and the colors are far more comfortable and far more easily separated out. In fact, Jupiter almost looks organic. It has colors which remind you of living things, as opposed to, you know, dirt or cloud or chemicals. See, but apart from that, we can see Jupiter and Saturn pretty much whenever we want, as long as it's in our sky. Mars, on the other hand, this happens to show on the left in slide 17. Mars at its very closest opposition, because the distance of Earth to Mars changes pretty severely depending on what part of the orbit Mars is in. Oppositions in April are near the aphelion, and Mars is around 7/10 of an AU away, and at the perihelion opposition in, say, August, Mars is around 3/10 AU away, and so we're going to have a radical range in angular size of like 6 to 1 or so. So using the same eyepiece or same imaging setup, you have a very close opposition on the left, and the surface markings on it are bold and easy to recognize. You have the polar cap at the bottom, and I don't know which is up north or south. I am guessing from rather faded memory of what the surface features are that north is at the top, but we'll come to that in a while. And then what Mars looks like near the superior conjunction. We almost never look at Mars in twilight because its color causes it to blend into the background sky. So you kind of have to wait until weak twilight or full night to view the planet. But that, if you want to go back to the Jupiter and Saturn lessons and dig out the slides where I showed the superior conjunction and opposition disparity of size, and you can see that Mars is rather more severe range of sizes. 18 is a stylized graphic which qualitatively shows the range of disk size depending on the month of the opposition, and at the top, where you have the Sun in the middle, the inner ring is the Earth's orbit with months labeled. That's the month of the opposition. And the outer is the orbit of Mars. And we have spotted on it sample disk sizes, we also show a little circle inside the disk of Mars, which is representing the polar cap, the north polar cap, where it is large or small during the particular opposition. The line of sight Earth to Mars is the year of the opposition, and then the separation in Earth-Sun units, or astronomical units. So the one we're in now is at the top, at the 12 o'clock position, and we're a little bit more than half an AU separating us, and it occurs in, oh, we have the constellations also, it occurs in Taurus. The ring there for the constellation names. The sequence in this picture starts with 2010 around 9 o'clock and then goes through the other oppositions all the way through the perihelion one in 2018 and not all that bad off in 2020. And that's why you have a large disk there and a rather small one back there in 2010, and the one in 2025 would be about duplicating the 2010 aspect. The appearance of the pole, where the polar cap on the north, which is the one depicted, is small, that's because it's spring and summer in the north, which of course melts the ice. But the opposite side of the planet, the South Pole, would be enlarging because it is fall and winter there. And conversely, if you have a large polar cap for the north, the southern one is small. Now, I come here, I'll point out, and we'll see it later, that the yin-yang among Mars observers, and also Jupiter observers particularly, that until the space age, we drew all our diagrams and showed all our pictures and illustrations and telescope views with south up, which was the tradition really going back to the early 1600s, when the telescopes improved enough to use optics that inverted the image. The very earliest scopes, like the one Galileo had, used optics similar to field glasses or spy glasses, where the image is right side up. But you couldn't get high magnification, and to boost the power, we did have to go through an inverted image system. And that prevailed all the way until the 1960s, even into the 1970s. But with the space age, with pictures returned from the spacecraft visiting these planets, perfunctorily the images were published with north at the top, the way they had been publishing space views of the Earth. But observers of the planets like to keep their records consistent, so if they pull out the logbook of an observatory and see features on Jupiter, say they're looking for comet or possible comet asteroid impacts on Jupiter, they occur in one or the other hemisphere. It would be nice to know that all the pictures are oriented the same way, so you can say, okay, these occurred in the northern hemisphere, these occurred in the southern hemisphere on Jupiter, without worrying that in 1980 the observatory started making its drawings of Jupiter with north at the top, and any analysis you do across that boundary would be totally frustrated and probably even have to be scrapped. So Mars observers commonly continue to post their work with south at top. And so in the following slides, in many cases, I had to purposely put north up or South Up. I really hope that authors of news about Mars, especially now we're in the opposition cycle, will explicitly mark or in the caption say North Up or South Up. Okay? So that's what the little circle is mounted inside the disk of Mars. We come to a slice of the article Mars OPP2 noted in the title slide in slide 19. And this gives a slice from the opposition in 2018 through the ones in 2039. The first row, well, the figures in each row are explained at the top, which is row 1, row 2. The top of the two rows, row 1, gives information about the opposition itself. So the date of the opposition plus some parameters for the opposition. The second row gives the date when Mars actually hits proximity, the closest approach to the Earth, plus details about that. There is a distinction between opposition and proximity. Proximity does not, in general, coincide with opposition. In popular accounts of Mars, they're made to be coincident. And for the casual observer, and certainly the lay public who probably only read about Mars and just accept pictures and images that are published, it doesn't matter. But for us as astronomers, the opposition of 2003 really drove home the distinction, because that was about the closest possible opposition occurring very close to the perihelion on Mars's orbit. And there are all kinds of excursions and field trips all around the world to a place where the weather will be almost guaranteed clear to see Mars when it is closest to the Earth, but also to go to an elevation, a mountain on the Earth, so you get a kilometer or two closer to Mars than those who are viewing from sea level locations. It makes absolutely no difference in the appearance of Mars. A couple of kilometers on Earth over the tens of millions of kilometers out to Mars would be insignificant. So it was a marketing ploy, advertising, look, you come on my eclipse trip, or opposition trip, and you will be closer to Mars than anybody else in that country, the country we're reviewing from. Because we have an exclusive contract to use their highest mountain, even though there'll be sub-zero sea weather up there, to be closest to Mars. And then since then, home astronomers kind of got used to the idea that opposition and proximity are different. They can be many days apart if you look through the ones listed here. So you just bear that in mind when you hear someone say, oh, opposition, that's when Mars is close to the Earth. Well, it's in a zone of time when it will be closest to Earth, but not on the night of opposition. And for viewing Earth from the Earth telescopically at Mars, the few day difference wouldn't matter. In fact, it may be cloudy on the opposition date, but clear on the proximity date. Your drawings and images would be totally indistinguishable from those which you actually took on opposition. We have a timetable of Mars activity for our opposition in slide 20. I started with the perihelion of Mars, which was back in June, when Mars was way too far for any easy observing, and I continue into 2023 at the aphelion, and there we have there the stations and quadratures, and then the opposition on December 8th, and then the remaining columns with the headings give you like the distance away, the light accession declination, and the diameter of the disk. You already see just in the span from summer through the aphelion early next year a really wide swing in the angular diameter. See, but you may want to keep this handy, especially if you're planning viewing sessions for the planet. Here in slide 21, we see the change in the angular size of Mars on the approach to opposition. The figure on the far right is pretty close to the opposition date. And if you were observing back in the summer, when it was near perihelion, even though it's closer to the Sun, it's still pretty far from the Earth. I mean, you got the, actually, the only columns you need is the top is the date. The second line is the angular size, arc seconds, and the bottom last figure is the distance from Earth in astronomical units, the multiples of the Earth's orbit radius. The numbers in between, you can forget about it. As you see, we have a very small disk, which is probably uncomfortably small to observe with, but the size increases pretty rapidly into the retrograde loop, which is September, October, and then, actually October, and then into the opposition at December. In this particular picture, south is at the top. Any markings you see on the disk are, of course, they're simulations, because this diagram was cut by the author probably near the beginning of 2022. After opposition, the planet starts to recede from the Earth. Actually, the Earth is pulling away from Mars, increasing the distance between the two planets, and the disk size of Mars shrinks. So in 22, we have the opposition size, or close to the date of opposition, on the left, and then progressively as the months roll on, the planet gets smaller and smaller. By the time February comes, you're down to about 10 arc seconds, and for most of us, especially small, totable telescopes, we let go of it telescopically. We follow it then by binocular or skyscape photographs until in the spring, by the time we get to April, well, Mars will have moved out of Taurus and is plowing through Gemini, which is in the twilight sky by April. So that essentially closes, in a absolute sense, the apparition of Mars for this time. It surprises many people that Mars actually lingers in the sky inconspicuously as a second magnitude star, I mean inconspicuous for a planet, really almost until the end, let's say fall of 2023, in which case it then is ridiculously too close to the Sun, and there's a superior conjunction out around then also. Otherwise, we have a end of observation. It kind of corresponds to the eastern quadrature. Then the number of observers who are following the planet falls off precipitously. The 2022 opposition is about average, really. The planet is like half an AU away from the Earth at proximity. And slide 23 is a comparison of our opposition in the middle with the very best one on the left, which would be like 2003 or closely 2018, and a very poor aphelion opposition like in 2010 or what we'll probably get in 2025. See, so by all means, get your observations of Mars now, especially with those with smaller scopes. A question comes up. How does Mars take magnification in scopes? Actually, that's pretty good. However, there is a thing that's over-magnifying, where you're spreading out the light to make a bigger image, but then the contrast within the disk is way too low. And a general rule, which can be violated on the better nights, is that the maximum normal magnification of your telescope is equal to the aperture of the scope in millimeters. If you have a 120 millimeter telescope, then 120 power would be your normal maximum magnification. When the air is very still, if the object is a brighter one, you can go up to maybe 1.5 times, which would be more or less 200 power, or still about 180 power, and that probably tops it off. So don't be power hungry when viewing Mars, or for that matter, anything else. The rule in on your feet under the stars is you may use the highest magnification that gives you a comfortable, usable image. If you're not sure, use the next lower one from your selection of eyepieces. But that is the size of Mars compared to how we saw it in 2003. It's almost a third bigger, and the other one is about a third smaller on the right. Okay, so we are looking at Mars. Now remember, with Jupiter we were seeing swirls and really dynamic action in the clouds of Mars, and on Saturn, of course, it was pretty much a static picture, although you can see the vague bands on the disk and occasionally some white spots will erupt out. Mars, on the other hand, we're looking at a ground, admittedly through atmosphere of Mars too, and Mars rotates. It rotates in 24 Earth hours and about 36 minutes. The markings, the dark and light areas on the planet are permanent enough and stable enough that we can map them and actually give them names. So this picture shows several scenes from the Hubble Space Telescope, and North is at the top in these pictures from the text that surrounded the picture, so I put it up there in the caption. The rotation of Mars has shown different longitudes of the planet, and a few of the markers, the prominent ones, are listed. Of course, most of us who observe Mars at all recognize, when it's visible, the big triangular marking kind of in the center of the disk, in the lower right, Syrtis Major, that is the greatest swamp. The other, up at the upper left, as example, is Acidalium, or Mare Acidalium, because it's a dark area fancied in the early days of Mars observing to be water, and the light areas were imagined to be land. See, so we would probably, as home astronomers, notice the Maria because they tend to stand out, whereas the land areas are pretty continuous all around. Like we recognize on a globe of the Earth with no markings for countries or anything where the oceans are, but we may not know where the boundaries between countries are within the land masses. So it's the same thing kind of on Mars. Hence, we'd like to know, when we observe Mars, what face of Mars is turned toward us. That is, what meridian of longitude is in the middle of the disk. Okay, the markers on Mars are permanent enough. They do show secular changes, and I have that shown in a couple of slides for now, but in slide 25, is a map showing the features on Mars. And with their fanciful name, they all come from the Greek mythology, and this particular one is a traditionally oriented map. South is at the top. And actually I get that by looking at the latitude scale on the right and left edges. The negative latitudes are up, and the positive ones for the northern hemisphere are at the bottom. And then we see Hellas, and we see Acadalium, Serenium, Argyle, and so on. They're all from the Greek mythology, although some of them have been co-opted into place names on Earth. That is, a place took on one of the mythological names. And Amazonia, for instance. Now, of course, with the Amazon basin in Brazil, but that was named after the legendary place of Amazonia. No location, you know, really existed, but when the soldiers came from wars back to Greece and they described places they went through, which they had no idea where the hell they were, and they were told march here, march there, fight here, fight there, and when they came back, they had no sense of geography anyway. So, Mars will be turned in rotation, so one of these longitude vertical coordinate lines will be turned toward us, and the planet then is wrapped around by this map. Now, features near the edge of Mars, or the limb, apart from being distorted by for shortening, would also be diffused a bit because you're looking through a greater depth of the Mars atmosphere. So most of us who look at Mars would be content if we see any markings along the center of the disk. Hence, having a map like this, and you're looking into the eyepiece of the telescope, how do you know which one of these things oh, you see, by the way, there's your surface major a little to the right of center. Now, why that is it's a dense, dark, probably the darkest of the Mare. Why it's called a swamp rather than, say, an ocean, or at worst, a bay, I'll never know. Whoever put these names on in the 18th century, or probably even in the certainly in the 19th century, did their thing, and we'd be stuck with them. By the way, we have 33 slides in this lesson, so we are going into the home stretch. Okay, slide 26 shows a map of Mars, but this is compiled from spacecraft observations where many of the light and dark splotches we see from Earth were really coincide with geological or topographical features on the ground of Mars. So the names of those features, where practical, took on the names of the albedo or brightness features, as we often call the light, the chiaroscuro features, and you have the kinesia, regio, vastitas, and whatever. Note very carefully, the latitude scale, nought is at the top, because this was taken by, well, NASA or some such, where the north up is the convention, and most of the astronomers have followed that. But like I mentioned several slides earlier, planetary observers still have a lingering tendency to keep south at the top. Now, there's nothing wrong with this. And if they stay within their circuit of observers, it probably makes no difference. But when they disseminate their diagram, pictures, photos, whatever, to the general public or to other astronomers beyond Mars observers, confusion and actual mistakes can be made. So that's why I really urge anyone doing Mars observing and they present a map, a picture, a photograph, whatever, specifically state north at top or south at top. Don't just show me a bald picture with, oh, there's a polar south. I guess that's the South Pole. No. It could have been taken at opposition when the North Pole just was tilted to us and had the winter ice still on it. So remember, north up, south up, but make sure you say so. Okay, you come in from making a nice drawing of Mars, and you see some splash over here, the dark area over there, and maybe the lighter area up in that corner, and so on. Now you come in, and you want to be able to label the diagram, or in your notes, describe it. But how do you know what longitude is facing you? If you have a solar system plan, program, then we see an example of this in slide 27. And you get the info box set for the date and hour of your observing. And you kind of better get the hour to the nearest couple of minutes. The hour, within a couple of minutes, you should see central meridian, the longitude that is in the middle of the disk. And I boxed it for you here and pointed at it with an arrow. And it's so many degrees, and then I can take my map, say the one from slide 25, and see, okay, here's that longitude down here. Oh, I'm looking at that Maria. Oh, that white area is this land mass. And that gives you a much better satisfaction. Now, you may see thin white area, which maybe an hour or so later moved away. It didn't rotate with the planet, it had its own independent movement, but they may be the clouds. And you could probably see them best on the limb, because this way, put above the horizon, above the ground, they could project a bit beyond the limb. That would be a Mars cloud. See, but if you stay just with the ground features, that will tell you which way the planet is oriented. Another way, without a solar system program, is shown in slide 28. We turn to a very handy program. Sky and Telescope has its website, which I snapped the screen from it, called Mars Profiler. And you can actually key in the date. I just set the system time when I pulled this picture. And in addition, along the bottom, you can highlight, I boxed in direct view with north at top. In voided view, bottom center, would be with south at the top. And then mirrored, because our modern telescopes, plus any optical attachments you put onto it, may affect a east-west flip besides just north south, and you would like to know what the Mars looks like under those circumstances. And a very, very useful picture is the panel on the right, which is part of the view that you would see on Mars. The circle in the middle is the head-on dead center of the disk for the date and hour you set, and we have the major features that surround it. You know, the ones that you would easiest identify are along the north-south line, and the ones on the far right and far left would be kind of near the limb, and therefore might be either diffused by the atmosphere or simply distorted beyond easy recognition. And there you have the Amazonas, which is the mythical land. Incidentally, I'll tell you this story, shall we? When I was in Turkey for one of the eclipses there in the 20th century, we viewed from a town in northern Turkey, which the guide told us was the town of Amasya, or as I said it in Greek. Now, some people in my group were medical people, and they said, gee, that sounds like a condition where a woman has no chest, no breast. And the guide, of course, knew that, because he was explained when Alexander came into this area to conquer it, take it over, the natives of that region, to put up a good fight, they were in fact defeated. But then when the Greeks came in to bury the dead or to loot them or whatever, they were all, most of them were women. But a woman swinging a sword or working a bow and arrow would be inhibited if she had large front meat. So to prepare them as soldiers, their front meat, especially the right side, was amputated. And this was done by knocking the woman out or drugging her, so it's like the local anesthesia, slice the part off, and then using hot irons to seal the wound. And so the area was the place where women had no breasts, or the Amasians, which over time became Amazonia, or Amazonia. Now that is not where the actual place Amazonia was. That is still a mythical land. See, but that is where the word came from. See, while the markings on Mars are more or less fixed and stable, they do undergo changes secularly on a scale of one apparition. And so in slide 29, the author constructed a map based on observations in the 2005 and 2007 positions. And while the two maps look pretty much the same, you will see that there are annoying, niggling differences in any one particular feature. Now, before the space age, we really didn't know why this happened. First of all, we didn't know what these markings were. They were just areas of light and dark on Mars, and by analogy with the Moon, we imagined that the Maria were flat areas, like the Maria on the Moon, and the lighter areas were terrae with, you know, mountains and craters and whatever. Well, we didn't know about craters, but obviously mountains and valleys and so, but we surmised that because Mars does have what look like dust storms and clouds, that a part of one feature could be obscured while others may be revealed. If you live near a beach and you have a road or a parking lot by the sand, I'm sure you've seen that depending on how the wind blows, part of the ground will be covered by blown sand. And even if you come back an hour or so later, the distribution of sand will differ. So if you were mapping the parking lot, you would have to wait until the area you want is in the clear. Well, that probably in the 19th century and coming well into the 20th, like when I started astronomy, that's what the explanation was. So it is best for viewing the planet to cut from a Mars observing news source a map which maybe a skilled observer cut during the summer, maybe through August or even September, and then released it so that you folk can use it into the opposition and beyond. The markings kind of stay put for periods of months. See, but then you have that long dwell, 2 years, for the next opposition, and you can have the changes we see in these two maps. So there's no map of Mars in the way that there's a map of the Earth. You have to have a map of Mars for a certain year. Changes in the appearance of Mars and the visibility of the land or ground features can be pretty drastic. In slide 30, we see an extreme case which does happen annoyingly often. Mars, before the space age, we kind of thought had dust on the surface, and of course, having been there many times, the entire surface is covered with a layer of dust, like talcum powder dust, and that, surprisingly, because of the thin atmosphere, the pressure at the surface of Mars is only about 1% of Earth, about 1/100th atmosphere versus, well, one atmosphere on Earth. But that thin atmosphere is enough to cause meteoritic activity when a spacecraft is descending to the surface of Mars. You have to retrofire, try to slow it down, put heat shields on, you get the fiery ablation, a loss of radio contact, until the craft is slowed down, you can pop over in parachutes and so on. But that atmosphere is also strong enough to loft dust, and not just locally, but all over the planet. These are two pictures taken by Hubble showing the planet in the clear, not knowing there'll be a dust storm, and then puffo, within a month or two, the planet is essentially obliterated. Of course, orbiting spacecraft can no longer take optical pictures. I think they just go by radar, and craft on the surface that are using solar panels often have to shut down because the panels are covered up with dust. And you pray that when the dust clears, there'll be enough wind or maybe tiny whirlpools to clean it off. And this, we almost lost the InSight mission for that reason. The solar power generated by the panels kept falling because dust was settling on it, even though there was no actual storm as such, and we feared that if it goes below a certain level, the satellite was shut down, I mean the probe was shut down. But fortunately, for some reason, some wind came, blew off some of the dust, so we're still using the InSight mission, but eventually it's going to die because of that, the overwhelming by dust. Now here comes a very fascinating feature of Mars, which even advanced observers lose sight of. You see Mars in the sky, it has a reddish or orangey tint. But once in a while, maybe you didn't follow the news. You go out and look at Mars, hey, wait a minute, it's yellowy or white. Now, early astronomers noted this, especially the astrologers, and they factored into their mysticism the color tint of Mars. Of course, I had absolutely no idea what was going on. What happened? They had a planet-wide dust storm, which can actually enhance the brightness a bit because dust is more reflective than solid ground, and the color is more yellowy or white than the saffron or pink or whatever of the planet. Mars is the only planet besides Earth where physical changes on it can be seen with the bare eye from Earth. Way, way, way at the beginning of the lesson, I mentioned that the opposition of Mars this year is a double treat. Well, we took care of the main features of the opposition. We now come to the bonus. On the night, or day, depending on the time zone, of opposition, Mars is occulted, covered over by the moon. You remember that astrology horoscope I showed, where just to show more graphically the concept of opposition, and we saw Mars, and sitting pretty right next to it was the moon. Well, on that night, and you may have to look more carefully at your, well, here you can go to your lunar occultation news sources, as well as the Mars Observer. This picture in slide 31 is a world map, and it has what looks like an eclipse visibility path. Well, literally, the moon is eclipsing Mars. It's a simpler one because there's no penumbra, no partial phases as such. Any place within that elbow macaroni looking shape sees an occultation. The moon hits Mars, trudges along, and then uncovers him. Most of the United States, Quebec, Canada, Mexico in the Western Hemisphere, and just all of Europe in the Eastern Hemisphere get the occultation. The eastern seacoast from southern New England, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York City, Long Island, northern New Jersey, and eastern Pennsylvania, we see a near miss. Mars comes by the moon, squeaks past, only about a minute or so arc away, which would make a fantastic public event if you're doing anything for Mars on opposition night, and it would be a very nice photographic site, because you have this brilliant reddish star, far brighter than anything else in the sky, be it maximum brightness, sitting just south of the nearly full moon. The rest of the eastern coast down to Florida and then going over to the Gulf states sees a conjunction. Still very pretty, except that Mars would be farther away. And the whole rest of the world sees a conjunction. The farther from the occultation path, the farther apart are the two bodies. So the guys in Alaska and in southern South America see a conjunction with Mars maybe a degree or so away from the moon. So if you are favored in the occultation zone, be sure to cut a schedule of ingress, that is when Mars is covered, and egress when Mars comes out, and double check that the events are visible in the sky. That is, for instance, at the extreme left or west end, the occultation begins or is in progress at moonrise. So you may see the moon rise, even though it's moist. Well, it's already behind the moon, and then you will see the moon uncover it. At the eastern end, over there in Europe, going into eastern Europe, the occultation occurs at local moon set. So you may see Mars go behind the moon, then the moon sets. So that's a very, very fascinating sight. And it occurs essentially in dark sky. Well, of course, moonrise, moonset, they will occur when the sun is coming up. So you may get a bright twilight sky if you're near the extreme east or west ends of that path. In the middle of it, anyways away from the edges, you'll get the beautiful occultation, or near mist if you're in the city, or a very nice conjunction elsewhere. 32 gives more detailed information for New York City. The upper band gives detail for the mist, and the lower band advises that, hey, if you're in New York City, you can go north a couple hundred kilometers to the vicinity of Albany, let's say, that's our state capital, and you will see a graze. That is, the moon will just nick Mars, and with a telescope will pop up the power for this. You'll see Mars play peekaboo against the southern mountains on the moon. And the column are explained down at the bottom of the screen. But essentially you have the date and the universal time of the event. The event, M for miss, G for graze, the star, which is Mars, magnitude minus two something, woo-hoo! And you have the phase of the moon, which are essentially full, 180 degree elongation. And you have the azimuth, again, this is for New York, and then you have three angles, which are almost superfluous, because you're looking at a big bright star, and they're explained at the bottom. You have the cusp angle, which is pretty useless, because full moon has no cusps. The position angle is the angle around from celestial north, and you have the vertex angle, which is the angle around from the top, or zenith. This is the last slide in this lesson. Everyone, please leave the lesson, and thank you for riding with New York Skies. Hey, that seemed like pretty good. Okay, slide 33 shows a simulation, of course. The full moon with Mars sliding past her on the south side, as seen from New York on December 8th. So anywhere in the United States, if you don't get the occultation, you'll have a beautiful opposition sideshow with Mars and the moon. So that concludes our lesson, and now we come to the quiz. Way, way back, remember the slide showing the globes, the model globes of the planets? Your task is to use figures for the diameter of the Earth and Mars, figures for the amount of land area on Earth, Mars is all land, so it's 100%, and compare the land area of Mars with the land area of Earth. And when you get the answer, reflect on how long it took and what efforts were spent, expenses, casualties, shipwrecks, lost people, to explore the landmass of Earth. And that will give you an idea. If we try to colonize or settle on Mars, we probably won't know the whole planet on the ground by foot, maybe for centuries. So do that calc and post it to me. And for those who haven't used my own email or phone, slide number one, have them, especially for the new folk who never knew that all the rest of astronomy was conversing to me at work. Right? So, until next time, pray for clear skies.